This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. It's our Health and Living segment. And today we're going to be discussing our frontliners and, you know, the burnout that they're experiencing. Hospitals, quarantine centers, COVID-19 assessment centers in the Klang Valley have been bearing the brunt of an unending increase in COVID-19 cases. Now, with healthcare staff from other parts of the country being redeployed to provide support, the pandemic has taken an enormous sustained toll on frontliners all over the country for more than a year. What is the short and long-term impact of this on their mental health, and how do we address burnout in the healthcare system? Now, yesterday we saw hundreds of young doctors protesting their working conditions and what they've been going through over the last many months. So on the line with us to help us understand the psychological effects of burnout, and, you know, we have one individual who has experienced being in the front line, and they are Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq. He's a consultant psychiatrist. He's going to help us understand the psychological effects of it. And now on the ground, Dr. Mavisral Mamat, he's a consultant anesthesiologist. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. How are you today?
Good, thanks. Good, thanks, Mira. Good to be back.
Yes, good to be back always. Dr. Mavis, tell us about yourself. I mean, I understand that the early days of the pandemic when it hit Malaysia, you were crucial in helping to manage the ICU in Labuan, for an example. You want to just share that journey with us as to, sorry, that was Sungai Buloh first, right? You started off in Sungai Buloh. You just want to share that journey as to how you moved from Sungai Buloh to Sampurna and then off to Labuan?
All right, thank you, Mira. Okay. Hi, Ame. Okay, I think, well, to say that I am crucial is not me, but it's the team, and I was just being a part of how we were trying to face this particular pandemic. I think when it was in Sungai Buloh early last year, in April, there was a call by the, DG made a call himself asking for anesthetists, intensivists to help with Sungai Buloh Hospital because we have designated the Sungai Buloh Hospital as our COVID center. And since it was a lockdown, and I thought, like, yeah, why not? Because I've been doing humanitarian missions overseas, and this is my country calling. So why not? And this was at this stage where we were still learning. And ICU, as you know, is intensive care unit, is the last line of defense. And nobody really knew how to manage it properly. And when I went there, it was a steep learning curve. We did not really know what to expect, and certainly depended on online updates, what has been happening in China for a start, in Wuhan, and after that, how the wave came to Europe, to Italy, to Spain, and to the UK, and of course, to the United States. And we were just seeing, and what we were seeing then was what described themselves, especially regarding one of the complications in ICU, which is pulmonary embolism, which causes sudden death when patient is already ventilated. And I guess at that time, it was the learning curve. So the initial burden of wearing your PPE for that long hours, because ICU shifts is like 8 hours per shift, depending. And nowadays, with this current the current surge we're having, some are having 12-hour shift. And of course, it was those time learning. And I can say we were lucky that the patients we had, I mean, there were a number of them, a lot, but not as how we see it today. How it's like, it's more than exponential, what we're seeing now. And the stint there for about 1 month. And I guess at that time, it was only the public hospitals taking care of this. It was our strategy then. And then came Sampurna. That was like our third search. And I can tell you, Sampurna was the first community spread infection that actually happened. What we're seeing in Malaysia overall now is what happened in Sampurna. Because you do not know who has it, and you are always at risk. Of course, at that time, because it was only Sabah, so the whole of Malaysia, the other MOH medical officers, medical assistants, the nurses came over to help. And I think Sabah was really needed that help. Because part of the reason was not really that the healthcare workers were infected by the patients they care for, but by the community. So imagine, at one time, they were like the manpower for the hospital, for the PKD, the district health office, was down by 60%, and patients were coming. And we were lucky in a way at that time. It was the category 1, category 2, which is fairly stable. And I perhaps in Sampurna was the first when the low risk center, the PKRCs, were started. And it was then exemplified all over the country. Of course, MIPS was the other one in Peninsula Malaysia, mm-hmm. but Sabah in Sempurna, the first PKRC. And of course, it was the strategy when I was there in Sempurna was with an NGO. And what we did was to help with the district health office, where we were, the strategy then was to test and isolate. And one of the jobs I did was testing, do the testing in the islands. It was interesting in one bit, going to the islands, but because the numbers we had there, it was just not the nationals, but the non-registered nationals. I mean, in Sempurna, the number is massive. It is almost half the official figure. And considering what they have in terms of facilities, it could not cope. Even Tawa was struggling. And at that time, ICU in Tawa was bad. But in Sempurna, it was more towards the health side, so helping out. So I do really know when we call the frontliners what they do,
yeah.
and how tired, and you know, like or the day and the island, it was just, we imagine in the middle of the island, we're wearing the PPE and going around.
Gosh.
And it wasn't a surprise that the kampung, the village folks, the island folks ran away because they were not keen to be tested, you know. So we arrived at the island
yeah,
and
you look like an alien descending on the island, didn't you? Yeah, yes, I can imagine, yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it does scare me sometimes when I see people in a PPE in front of me. I can't imagine, you know, appearing on an island like that. Dr. Amir, did you want to say something?
No, I mean, I remember seeing your photos at that time, Dr. Mahfiz, and at that point, it was one of the first few times I saw healthcare providers wearing N95. I remember I was asking, you know, why suddenly the N95? We were all wearing normal masks, but already our friend was wearing N95. So I think that's really when you were faced with the fact that you did not know where the enemy was. I think in the peninsula of Malaysia, at the start of the COVID, you sort of roughly know there were clusters. But I think what Dr. Mahfiz was sharing is literally that first phase when anybody could have COVID and you could be exposed to it at any point of time. And then, of course, there was a lot of debate at that point, I suspect, in terms of whether it was airborne or droplets, wasn't it, at that time?
And as you said, was like Sempurna. I mean, what we're going through now is just a larger version of what happened in Sempurna, right, at that time. What about Labuan? You went on to do work in Labuan?
All right, okay. I think Labuan, at one point of time, Labuan had the worst mortality, death rates due to COVID that we have. And I think in the initial report when Labuan had this surge, maybe about 1.5 or 2 months ago, it was all Delta variant. So they were like maybe the first really Delta variant of type of infections they get. I think just for everybody's information or maybe revision, what is deadly about Delta variant is the demographics of patient infected changes. Before, we would say that those who are high risk with comorbids comorbid diseases, as well as the elderly are at risk. But with this Delta variant, even the younger ones are at risk. And there were, in fact, maternal mortality, infected pregnant mothers, and the mothers died of this. So, and of course, Labuan is a small island. The population is only about 100,000. And the problem is, usually their health system, what they do is they would go for, if they have difficult cases, they will refer it to either Kota Kinabalu or Kuching. But both are like on lockdown. So there was the inability to do this usual practice of transfer. So they needed help and the numbers were big. And what we did was the collaboration between, of course, MOH, the Army, as well as the NGO Mercy Malaysia to build out a field hospital with ICU level 1 capabilities. So I was there to set it up and also did some training for them to cater this. Because things like you can't imagine, like you have oxygen supply problems, not just oxygen but the space that they to deliver this type of care. So it was not possible, so they needed to expand the capacity as fast as possible. So that's why we were in there to hold on to that. And I think at the same time, what the health did in the cooperation with the hospital as well was to ramp really up on their vaccination. And I guess that is the strategy that we have, because the idea of vaccination, probably not. I mean, if we can totally forbid the disease, it's good. But we know that even with vaccination, we can get infected. But how bad we get infected, that means we do not progress to hospitalization or even ICU. That is the target. And that's why we were there to hold on to whatever has happened. Because as we know, if you get bad diseases with COVID is because it's like 2 weeks ago. It's 2 weeks ago story. It's not like 2-3 days. So you have to calculate and estimate and anticipate what is going to happen. And that's what we did to anticipate and prepare the tertiary services for care and at the same time, the ramping of the vaccination. And I'm glad to know, I think but today is it 80%? Of adult above
yes.
18 in Labuan has been
Labuan, yeah, Labuan has done extremely well. To think that there was a, they were a case study then, and they're a case study now. It's interesting.
In fact, our field hospital has stand down last weekend, so it's like closed and open up for low risk center rather than for tertiary. High-level ICU or oxygen delivery care.
Wow, fantastic. Can you explain, you know, while all of this was going on, can you explain your colleagues and yourself and, you know, being in the front line, what was that like? You know, they've been through so much. Could you just describe it for us? You know, and you would have been there affected as well.
I think it's both places. Like I think in Sempurna, in Sungai Buloh, it was fairly new. So everybody was hype up and, you know, looking forward to see what's going on. In Sempurna, because they themselves are, what do you call that, the place for infectious disease center. So it was just not about, COVID was just another big type of disease which has happened. I mean, they still have cholera there. So imagine, they still have cholera outbreaks, etc. So on top of it now is COVID. So they were really overwhelmed and, you know, going on to do this work. And certainly our presence was greeted with much enthusiasm. And they were like, so thank you, you know. And sometimes what we do, the mobilization done by KKM to all these regions is to help to relieve them, yeah. You know, because they've been doing this all day, all night. In Sempurna, because, you know, like in health district, it's what we call the health inspectors. Not just medical officers, and they do tracing. They go and imagine in what they have. This is this village on the water for the Bajau Lauts. Yeah, so these are the nationals which live there, and they're like in 20,000s and having to trace and go into this area every day, looking at hundreds of people contact tracing. You imagine 1 to 4 the minimum. When you contact trace and you try to find out and try to get them, and they were definitely very, very tired. But I must say, in Sempurna, I was very enlightened as well to see them that way. And it made my spirit to, okay, let's do this. Let's help them and see what we can do. But at the same time, as I can say, because the infection was all over, you do not know, there are teams who came over to help. And unfortunately, after 2 days, they became positive. And the whole team got quarantined. And you imagine their term is 2 weeks. So in the end, they had to take extra week because they were admitted to the low-risk centers. So they themselves felt quite down because they were there to help and they became a burden.
Yeah.
So it's all this. And I guess when things go down, everybody feels okay. Perhaps it's coming to an end. But yeah, and I think 2021 hit all really hard.
Yeah.
And especially the whole country.
The end doesn't seem to be coming. And so that's the thing, right, Dr. Amir? We expect our frontliners to be resilient, but there are limits to how much stress they can actually handle. What have you observed over the last 16 months? Dr. Amir?
Well, I think what we've definitely observed, what Dr. Mahfiz was sharing was literally a continuation of stress building up from March all the way until now, July, moving to August of the next year. There has not really been a break for these frontliners. They've just been either trying to manage whatever expectations they have in terms of the places that they are, or they've been deployed into other areas and continuing the journey in a different form. So initially, it was probably managing A&E for some of them, then it's moving towards the wards. And then some of them probably are deployed into, as Dr. Mahfiz had said, towards screening and detection. And then they've moved on towards vaccination. Literally, they've just been continuously deployed. And I think the prolonged ongoing pandemic is causing a lot of damage in terms of not only your physical healthcare, because most of them, the leaves are also frozen because there's just not enough people. But then, of course, at the same time, having to deal with, increasing amount of stress due to the increased number of cases that come forward. And now, more importantly, the cases that we do not know where they are. And then, of course, looking at people breaching SOPs and thinking, OMG, the A&Es are going to get overwhelmed. And of course, if the A&Es are overwhelmed, then it's a trickle-down effect. The wards are going to get overwhelmed. And then those who are working, as Dr. Mahfiz said, the last line of defense, the ICUs, they also get overwhelmed. So I think this chronic stress does result in individuals having a lot of mental health issues. And I think we've discussed this a little bit whereby, you know, we've done a lot of other mental health psychosocial support services within hospitals to support colleagues that are struggling with their mental health as a result of this pandemic. Amira.
Okay. We'll come back and continue this discussion. If you are a healthcare frontliner and you want to share an experience, give us a call. If you have a question for Dr. Mahfiz or even Dr. Amir, give us a call. It's 777-332-900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's Health and Living. It's Mind Matters. Today we're discussing our frontliners and, you know, the burnout that they're experiencing thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic. On the line with me, Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq. He's a consultant psychiatrist, and Dr. Mahfiz Rao Mahmud. He's a consultant anesthesiologist. And we're discussing the whole idea of burnout and how our healthcare workers have been coping with this prolonged, heightened stage of stress that they've been through over the last 18 months. And we can't even see the end of it at the moment. Not at the moment anyway, until we hit vaccination rates of, you know, on much higher levels. We still got some way to go. And this stress will continue to be there, Dr. Amir. I mean, how do you cope with it? How does it affect the ability to work in this prolonged state of, you know, heightened stress, as I was saying just now?
Well, I think in terms of how it's affected colleagues, as we've already seen, even from the experience at the very beginning of the pandemic, mainly it's been stress and distress and sleeping difficulties that were the first symptoms that were seen by a number of people. And of course, as we know, as sleep is disrupted, for those at risk, then they might develop other mental health issues, particularly things like depressed mood and anxiety. But as the pandemic has moved forward along its 16, 17, 18 months of its journey, we're seeing now more and more individuals struggling emotionally, particularly with depression as a condition in itself, anxiety. And there have been a number of reports. And again, I've not seen this particularly so much in Malaysia per se, looking out for it. But internationally, they've been reporting a number of people experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder-like symptoms, causing individuals to have difficulties in sleeping, for example. Anxieties are related to the workplace, and then, of course, a number of flashbacks. But this has also been reported in the literature among one of the other mental illnesses and conditions that have come up as a result of this prolonged pandemic for our healthcare workers. Definitely having any health problem, whether it's physical health, mental health, or even social well-being, will definitely impinge a little bit on the productivity of our friends. Definitely, in terms of those who are struggling emotionally as a result of this prolonged pandemic, will also be struggling in their productivity at work. And again, as I've mentioned just now, this is a little bit unique. You know, in the past, there are things that we could do, like, for example, take long breaks, maybe even go for short breaks on holiday. But all of that has not been able to be done because every man and woman needs to be in the field to actually attend to the number of cases, as we've seen, rise in the five digits now over the last few days. So it's really been tough on friends out there in the field, like what Dr. Mahfiz had shared a little bit just now.
Dr. Mahfiz, how did you all support each other?
I think, in terms of supporting each other, I reckon the one of the problems, I mean, I wouldn't say it's a problem, but I think this has been inbuilt into us as healthcare worker, that we take care of others, that is more important than taking care of ourselves.
That's
somehow.
True.
You may remember, during our housemanship, you know, we are dogged, I'm using that word, to work effortlessly, tirelessly, despite how we are, and we were being put into guilt to say that if you don't do this, you're not doing for your patient. And imagine do that every day in and out. And that mentality stayed until, from before and until now. Perhaps with this new generation, they have shift system, it is a bit different, but the thinking is still as such. Hence, having this prolonged stress upon this pandemic has put a toll on this. As we can see in what we call how it affects the performance, apa Yerkes-Dodson, Yerkes-Dodson,
yep.
Betul kami? There's this people can Google who's listening. This graph, we're talking about the performance, how it's affecting. Everybody needs a little bit of stress that makes you work better, flight or flight. But at certain point of time, when it's overload, you get exhausted. And when you got a burnout, then everything comes. You go into anxiety, you get panic, you get anger, you can't control your emotions, yourself, to others, and then breakdown. And then we come to the psychiatric issues, terms of like depression, you know, anxiety that turns into, conditions which they can't control themselves. So that's the thing. I believe this has to do a lot with the management who's taking care of the whole system, the leadership. I believe this must come from them to see how people work in terms of the rostering, the health well-being, not just the doctors, but the nurses, as well as all the healthcare workers. And in every time, you know, you huddle up, you give this motivation. I think this is important. And if the workers are being led on their own for so long without direction, I mean, just peer taking care of each other. And that's why we see what's going on, as you mentioned earlier, regarding the protest, which happened yesterday. I think it built up from that as well. When feeling unappreciated, you know, you do your work for, I mean, there's also a sole reason you want to do this. It's for the country, for people, for your family, yes. But when you feel that you are being forced and not taken care after, any human being will react that way. It's just that when the doctors become and becomes a hoo-ha big thing, but it's normal. I think if you go for unions or anything, it's something more trivial that people protest. So I guess this is the way and how the reaction that we see as such. But the self-support, definitely, in terms of peers, the superiors having to give them breaks, you know, in between. We know we're busy. When we're not busy, we have to do that. I believe in that. I think in my training that I do, I put this emphasis important, the PFA, the psychological first aid for the healthcare worker.
So what I'm hearing is that you're saying there's, you're supporting each other, but there's only so much you can do to support each other. And what's lacking now is the overall leadership of better planning and management of resources. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think, okay. I may be strong on this part of opinion, but I believe when we go into this pandemic, okay, initially maybe people think this is like fighting a disease. But in fact, what has happened, and especially this year, we are facing war. This is a war, a different type of war, which may be not being done or being by anybody before. And when you are in a war, it's totally different. The healthcare workers are actually like full soldiers defending the country. And this is the mentality that the leadership should have. You know, they play a key role. You can see towards the centuries. I mean, I love history. You know, charismatic leaders lead the impossible to wins. The Great War, Alexander the Great, conquest of Jerusalem, Muhammad al-Fateh, World War II, Hitler. In the initial part, because how they conquest, yeah. But what the Churchill, we shall fight in the beaches. We shall never surrender. You know, those kind of motivation should come to this to the healthcare workers as well. The in terms of the plan as well as motivation for all to continue. I mean, because it's a hard war. I mean, any soldiers, even in a real war, they would not know. But the motivation that has been given to for them to move on and to know the objective, I think that is very, very important.
You're a champion, La. We should put you in that position, Dr. Muffet. I mean, really, said with so much passion and, you know, but during a pandemic, is this quite normal? Is this expected of, you know, during a pandemic? We've been through pandemics in the past. It is a situation which is not normal, right? But you cope however best you can, but of course, we can do things a lot better, right? So yesterday, we saw the walkout among hundreds of junior contract doctors taking place in many government hospitals. So what's the mental health impact on younger healthcare workers compared to senior healthcare workers? Is there a difference at all? Either one of you want to take this question, Dr. Amir?
Well, I think, to be fair, I think it's definitely going to be different because different and the same. The same in the sense that what's going on at the moment is affecting everyone that's doing healthcare provision. Like I said before, really even psychiatrists and other, specialties that often don't go on the ground are actually on the ground at this point of time. So as Dr. Mafitz had rightly mentioned, in a war, everybody is sort of accounted for at that point of time. Your daily routine jobs are probably not the same, which means that senior colleagues, junior colleagues are all doing roughly the same thing, whether you're a general practitioner, whether you're in private or public services, you're actually contributing towards assisting Malaysians that are struggling at the moment with the pandemic. But I think the difference between a junior colleague and a senior colleague in the notion that we were looking at yesterday was that senior colleagues are probably more established in wherever they are. They've really been able to do the things that myself and Dr. Mahfiz are able to do. Whereas junior colleagues, they are, you know, planning their future. And when the future looks a little bit bleak in view of the, you know, the way that they, you know, the inability to train the future, for example, and of course, in terms of job security, despite having sacrificed, you know, hours and days and months and almost now a year into this, it really makes it, as Dr. Mahfiz had rightly mentioned, painful for them. And therefore, you know, as we are dealing with our own stress in handling people as a result of the pandemic, they're also not only doing the same thing that we're doing, but they're also thinking of their future. And I think this is where it gets really painful for a number of them. This is where that, you know, you're pushing so hard, but the end, it, you know, looks quite bleak. And I don't know how it is for them to be fighting that kind of war. I mean, people like us, we've already established ourselves. We're helping where we can. But, you know, the situation looks a little bit more hopeful. But I think for junior colleagues that are really aspiring to be surgeons, psychiatrists, anesthesiologists, and other forms of medicine, and also other colleagues like in pharmacy and dentistry, for example, you know, then suddenly having the situation where you've worked so hard and, it, you know, you've got no job at the end of 2 years, I think it's really quite devastating. And as Dr. Mahfiz had said, they've only learned, you know, the only way that they've been brought up in a way in medicine, any part of medicine, is to actually literally sacrifice yourself in order to help people. And you sort of forget about your own self and your own self-care and the things that are important to you until it sort of hits you, like maybe a 6 month down the line or 3 months down the line, or God forbid, 2 months down the line. And then that's when you start to really start to crumble a little bit. And we can't afford that at this point of time.
Okay. I think they did a wonderful job yesterday, terribly professional. They wanted to get a message across. They did with hardly any disruption, which, you know, hats off to them, to all the junior doctors, I have to say. I was watching videos and I think they did it terribly well. I hope, you know, that we respect that they did it in a very professional manner and, you know, and not take anyone to task as a result of that, because, you know, we need, I mean, they're there. They just want to be heard, right? And I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. Do you see, can you distinguish who needs support and treatment at this stage? You know, Dr. Amir, Dr. Mahfiz?
Well, I think in terms of psychological support for colleagues in the field, everyone needs it at this point of time. And that's why I think the Ministry of Health has very early on set up the mental health psychosocial support services that is literally open to all healthcare providers within the hospitals. They're normally run by the Department of Psychiatry in these respective hospitals, if not by the state, you know, the state services. In fact, just before I came on board, we were discussing internally in my university, for example, two colleagues are literally helping almost exclusively to two particular departments that are heavily involved, namely anesthesiology and also in the emergency department. And I think these are probably the areas where you're going to see a lot of difficulties in terms of managing emotions, in terms of having to be there day in, day out. And I think this is where most of the support is. However, as we mentioned, everybody is playing their part. And therefore, the psychosocial support service is available throughout the hospital for those that are in need. And most of us already know where we can actually access the service within the ecosystem of the respective hospital. So, you know, everybody needs it at this point of time. We provide it for everyone. But, you know, some people might need it a little bit more. We're seeing a number of increased cases of individuals, colleagues actually coming forward seeking professional help too, you know, particularly for depressed mode and anxiety. We're also hearing colleagues that are starting to be, as Dr. Mahfiz said, having what we call emotional dysregulation. A quiet person, a more composed person suddenly breaking out. We've seen that. And I think you're also seeing that on social media, where traditionally we don't see a number of healthcare providers speaking out. But I think, you know, in view of their own emotional needs, they've been using social media as a platform to ventilate some of their concerns and also their frustration towards the whole situation. And I think this is just a symptom or a signal that people are actually in distress at this point of time.
Okay, we're discussing frontliners and burnout. Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq, a consultant psychiatrist, and Dr. Mafitzral Mahmud, a consultant anesthesiologist, sharing their experience with us. If you have a question or you want to share your experience as a frontliner, you know, during this pandemic, give us a call. It's 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. If you have just joined us, it's our Health and Living segment. We're discussing in our Mind Matters series, we're discussing frontliners and burnout. Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq, Amir Nordin, a consultant psychologist, psychiatrist, I apologize, and Dr. Mafitzral Mahmud, a consultant anesthesiologist, on the line with me, discussing and sharing their experience with healthcare workers and frontliners and, you know, what they're actually dealing with at the moment. It's been, what, 16, 17 months, very prolonged stress levels, distress, as you said, Dr. Amir, you know, sleeping issues, all of that, difficulties coming to the fore now. It's interesting that there is support in hospitals for the doctors, and some of them are coming forward. However, do you feel that there is like a stigma that as a healthcare worker or a frontliner, you shouldn't be going forward for help because you are supposed to be able to manage this? Is there any amount of stigma or discrimination as far as that's concerned, Dr. Amir?
You know, does he feel stigmatized to seek help like us?
Have you seen Dr. Amir?
Very good question.
Did you feel you needed to see him to actually talk to him about things?
I think at a certain point of time, especially the senior ones, because we are being brought in the time where, I mean, it's not that long, I'm still young. but
well, you didn't march yesterday, I'm sure.
yeah, we tend to maybe call for help late. I think as a doctors ourselves, I think this is a possible biggest problem that we have among the healthcare worker to come out to help, especially, I would say, mental health, because we always think we can cope. And we sometimes it's not about the stigma, it's the reluctance, because we reckon we are in control. I think this is the point where everybody, especially the healthcare workers, should be aware which is their breaking point and when they should seek help. Especially just maybe simple, just to talk things over. And, you know, like currently, because, for example, I think what the issues can be in the critical care areas or even for the medical officers being deployed or even nurses. When the other healthcare worker deployed from a non-critical to critical care, they may be doing simple, say, I mean, psychiatry is not simple, but, okay, I mean, not the same as psychiatry is simple. I'm just saying that nurses in psychiatry having, imagine, they usually deal with psychiatry patient, and now they have to deal with critical, possible collapsing COVID patients. So this brings to us, to them, in terms of it will challenge them in a way that, I should be able to cope. But when they can't, they may be reluctant initially, but if it is overwhelmed, definitely. This is somewhere I think as fellow healthcare worker, we should look out for each other to identify this. This is very, very important. And I think I just would like to add on to what I think Dr. Amir mentioned earlier, why they are looking at healthcare worker in anesthesia, in ICU, in emergency department to be something to look at. It's because of this other factor. Maybe looking at sick patients is not something that we are not familiar. But the issue here is how it is being communicated. Imagine the healthcare worker is the last line, the main communicating tool between the family members and the patient at two stages. One, at when they become critical, which means when they need ventilation and intubation, you know, sometimes it's the nurse will be or the medical officer will be entrusted to handle this. And there are no particular training to do this. And imagine the emotion that is involved, especially when you're with that patient for a long time. And when you're telling the family that, okay, it's maybe it's time, we can't do anything anymore, and perhaps your parents are, your parent, your father, your mother is dying. Imagine being in that position. I've had in my medical offices broke down because they have to do this daily report every day to the family. And whether you like it or not, we're human beings. Sometimes we get attached to our patients as well. You know, we get attached, and imagine having to inform this bad news. I had my medical officer broke down. She just cried after the phone call. And I took over the job. I said, it's okay, you go and rest, and I'll go through the list and inform the family members. And I have nurses as well who just cried when the patient, I mean, after caring for them in 20, 25 days in ICU and seeing them getting better and suddenly just succumb to the disease. I mean, and to inform the family, you know, the having to tell that and imagine the process of informing, sometimes there's denial from the family side. So it's not easy. So this takes a toll in terms of their mental health to work and to do this every day. So yeah, I guess the stigmatization as such, I think when you are too much into it, you need your peers to help them to be channeled into what is proper for them.
Yeah, so I think continuing on to that conversation, you know, this is where the mental health psychosocial support services comes in. It's really to prevent individuals from struggling the way that Dr. Mahfiz had shared. However, there are going to be definitely some specialties that are going to be more affected than others. But in keeping with that, a number of colleagues have come forward, and there is still a level of stigma among us to seek a member, colleague, particularly for a mental health issue as well. So this is where people are worried about things like training, people are worried about things like productivity as well, people are worried about things like long leave. Yeah? Again, going back to the adage that not only are they thinking about themselves, more so they're thinking about whether they can actually help others during that point of time. And I think this is where we've got to remind colleagues that in order for you to help others, you've really got to help yourself. And our job is mainly trying to prevent people from getting illnesses, including mental health problems. But at the same time, if you are struggling, we try to make it as easy for you as possible to be able to access that service within the hospital that you're in, or at least you know, among colleagues. So we've seen a number of people come on the private side quietly seeking the help just to be able to perform in their day-to-day job. But you know, we can't deny the fact that just as the community is struggling with stigma in terms of seeking help, even within the profession also, there's that stigma too.
Yeah, Dr. Mahfiz, did you think at any point you were reaching, you were coming to the breaking point?
I would say yes. There were a few times when, especially when things get overwhelmed, you know, you feel you've done everything that you could, but it's not doing well. And you know, I guess as doctors as well, we have this thing that you reckon you can do it, but over the years, I've tend to overcome that. But yeah, in COVID, especially when you get overwhelmed, and in the initial stage, I mean, I'm in the private sector at the moment, starting January. This year, we were to take these COVID ill patients in, and alhamdulillah, I mean, we are quite ready and we were doing it. But yeah, at times when, you know, when you have to tell, I think the point where I feel it's difficult is when you have to tell patient that I can't continue to treat you anymore, or you are not to be, I mean, the issue is whether you are ventilated or not ventilated, you know, and to tell that to them clinically and to consider all emotions or what family thinks, it's not easy, especially now when it's the younger patients, when you have to choose that way. But as much as possible, we try not to do that, especially now.
Were you ever put in that position where, you know, for the lack of a better word, you had to play God, you had to decide who to save and who not to?
In the government, when I was with the government, yes. It is something not just during this pandemic, it was even before. Imagine, before even the pandemic, ICU, we have to do that. We had to do that. Certain times when it becomes overwhelmed with a defeat, because the ICU is always full. There's never a time which ICU is not full. So imagine this time, you have to create that other ICU, share, and still it's full, and it's getting more. I mean, currently the reported confirmed case in our statistics is more than 1,000. So we've never had that capability of normal ICU in Malaysia. I mean, our capability before, maybe about 900 to 1,000 tops for all other diseases. I'm talking other cardiac. I mean, you have your heart, your lungs. I mean, all other diseases was 1,000. And now 1,000 is already in ICU on top of the other, maybe another 600-700 ICU beds, which is available for other. So as you see, it's not easy to make the decision. But I guess that's why you have to have the consultant to be really in charge, as well as to be the decision makers. So because it is based on that experience and that guilt. I mean, you can't get away with the guilt. You can say that, okay, I'm all right, and say that it's okay. You will think, and when you see the family members again, it will come up again, you know, what the conversations you had. So yeah, it's not easy. it's not easy.
I mean, after, how do you cope? I mean, you put in this situation where, you know, nobody asked to be in this situation, but you got to make the call, right?
Well, yeah, I think in terms of even for us in mental health care, we've seen a rise in cases that have been sort of more than we would want to, you know, see before. And we're seeing them not only in the elderly, but also in the young population. I think we've had that discussion before among mental health care among the young, which we're seeing a rise in. And definitely similarly with Dr. Mahfiz, but in a different form, we've also been going through that period where we're just feeling overwhelmed with the cases. You know, I've always spoken out about this, that as we're fighting with COVID-19, we're also slowly forgetting that there is a hidden pandemic that's sort of coming together with COVID-19, which is the mental health pandemic. You know, but similarly with our colleagues in anesthesia, there's only so much of us out in the community. And there's so much we can do for fellow Malaysians that are struggling with all that is mental health, right? Poverty, for example, financial difficulties and what have you. So in terms of, you know, what we've done, you know, again, in terms of the services to assist colleagues is, of course, one is MHPSS. Secondly is in terms of, as Dr. Mahfiz had spoken to, about changing certain working environments. I know that there are some places where they provide breaks, they provide certain time off, although theoretically people are not having that time off, for example. We've also gotten a lot of support from the community in terms of, for example, you know, those you know, free meals that comes in along the way. Yeah. Again, these are just sort of pat on the backs that help people and colleagues to actually feel much appreciated and also knowing that what they're doing has some value. Because I think one thing that we forget in terms of improving mental health care is meaningful engagement. And I think when you are doing something where people are at least saying thank you or, you know, giving you in kind to say their thank yous as well, that really helps in actually increasing motivation and also improving the mental health care at that point of time.
Okay.
I think there's also a new push now for some of my senior colleagues to support junior colleagues by making sure that they have adequate time for their families and also for themselves. Mainly in terms of sleep, you know, it's just that, you know, these small little things, I think, is what really makes it really important to colleagues particularly. And I think having a senior that allows them to do so is also quite helpful. We've also seen some of our seniors, for example, in terms of yesterday's event, in a way protecting their junior colleagues. And again, that's another show that they are appreciated. Small little things like this that we take for granted in a normal day-to-day situation, it plays a huge impact in the mental health and well-being of colleagues, particularly as they're trying to help us in fighting against COVID-19.
Dr. Mahfiz, would you have a message for healthcare workers?
this is
Or if you have a wish tough. List, or you know, start. Let's start with the first question. Sorry, I'm going to go back a little. What's your message to leadership?
My message to leadership, I think. We must always have this, what we call situational awareness. We must be aware of what situation we are in. Sometimes when we plan for something, yes, it may work at one time, but if it's not working anymore, so we have to change that. It's okay to change the plan, to change the overall thing, but importantly, because it's not a show of weakness, but it is a show of maturity. To see and maybe perhaps the strategy should be changed. But of course, when we make this strategy, involve everybody, let everybody feel that they are involved in these decisions. Hence, you will get everybody to totally support. Otherwise, when you are in the unknown, and that's when frustration, that's when the feeling of protest and answering that what have we been doing. Exactly like now, since January, we've been on lockdowns time and time again, but we only see numbers increasing. I think it's not healthcare worker. The public themselves are asking what's going on. And a very strong leadership point should come out and say why and explain. And perhaps to bring all together. Because we are all in this fight together. It's just not us Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, the Southeast Asia. They are all having this surge and disaster as well. So it's okay to do that. And get everybody to work together. And then we have to give the leadership a chance as well. But at the same time, I think we should all have the ability to express what we feel things should be changed or a different strategy, but involve everybody.
Your message to healthcare workers?
to healthcare worker, I mean, I can only say we have to persevere. But despite persevering with this disaster, take care of yourself. Think about yourself as well. Are you coping well? I think that is most important. In disaster management, the first person that one is, you will always think, humanitarian will always think of others. No, the principle is always think about ourselves because we are helping people and we have to ensure that we are okay. If we are not okay, then we will not be helping the potential many people that we can help.
Dr. Amir?
Well, I think, echoing what Dr. Mahfiz had said, if you're taking care of your health, also take care of your mental health. As I've shared before and again, that we are not only fighting COVID-19, but we are also struggling with a pandemic in terms of mental health care. It's really important that this is the time when you put the emphasis in terms of your mental health. Make sure that you have adequate sleep. Make sure that you exercise regularly. Make sure that you do your self-care. We've talked about this over and over again. These are activities that really you enjoy, particularly to improve on your health, physical health, social well-being, and also mental health. And I think also most importantly, now is really trying to find what really stirs you. Meaningful engagement is really important. Engagement in general is important. And I think this, is something that we have not appreciated as much. More importantly, for my friends out there, if you really need that help, again, look up into your services. There are the MHPSS, as we call it. And also, of course, friends in psychiatry are more than happy to help you out if you're struggling with your emotional needs.
Gentlemen, thank you for joining me today. Associate Professor Dr. Amir Siddiq, Amir Noordin, consultant psychiatrist, and Dr. Mahfiz Rael Mahmud, consultant anesthesiologist on Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.